Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes. One, two, three.
Hello, Ann Arbor and the world. Thank you for tuning in on this lovely Friday, April 11th, to WCBN FM 88.3. We are It's Hot in Here, and I am Andrea Krause with the lovely Professor Rebecca Hardin, who will be co-hosting a fantastic show on which we'll actually be interviewing a student team from the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. The student team has been doing research for at least a year now on environmental justice organizations' liability and trade. Rebecca, can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Happy to, Andrea. This project actually came out of a conversation with Professor Joan Martinez Allier, who is a professor at the Autonomous University in Barcelona and has been involved for several years now with a European Union-funded project, EJOLT, or Environmental Justice Organizations, Liability and Trade. They've been mapping environmental conflicts all over the globe, but they didn't have points on the map for, you guessed it, the United States, of all places. Turns out we've had some amazing environmental conflicts right here in North America, and we're going to tell you all about them this hour. We're going to report back as well from our student team, student faculty team's work and their presentations at a recent meeting in Europe with the EJOLT conference folks, with the European Environmental Agency in Copenhagen. And so we're really excited to fill everybody in and talk about environmental conflicts worldwide and the links between environmental justice at home and abroad. But first, let's hear a little anthem about environmental justice. Maybe something kind of classic. I'd say maybe Marvin Gaye, Mercy, Mercy Me. Oh, yes.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Now, now, where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Lost, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more be used from man? Mercy, can't you stand?
Welcome back to It's Hot in Here, 88.3 FM, Ann Arbor and the World. Today we are talking about environmental justice as a transnational set of movements that interlock. We're looking at something really interesting. This is Rebecca Hardin, and I'm telling you about the EJ Atlas. That's a really amazing initiative that you may have seen on your University of Michigan homepage recently. The University of Michigan News Service recently ran a story about the folks in studio with me today. SNRE, School of Natural Resources and Environment students, Sarah Orvis, and her teammates, one of whom is not in the studio with us, I should say, Katie or Catherine Hinson, who did a lot of work on this project. But sitting next to me, I do have both Bernadette and Alejandro and Sarah. We're going to talk to each of them in turn about how they came into environmental justice and became involved in this project. Before we get started, though, let me see if I can quickly just give you an overview of what's just happened with this. That atlas went live, I think, in late March, right? So correct me if I'm wrong, Bernadette.
It was mid-March, I believe, is when it went live, and they received a lot of hits in the first 2 weeks, so they were excited about.
Pretty amazing. And with that launch came a lot of media, particularly in Europe right now. This is a worldwide atlas with lots of cases, but if I recall, it was covered by the media in Europe, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, it was covered on Le Monde Diplomatique. It's a really important newspaper in France, and that got a lot of cover. And it was a lot of attention in France about what conflicts were included in France and whatnot.
So that's great. We got pushback about, hey, wait a minute, why are these conflicts on the map and our conflicts aren't on the map? Which is exactly what it sounds to me like the project organizers wanted, right? Was to create controversy and put environmental justice conflicts in the public eye. So exciting. Over 1,000 cases already on this map. And for those of you who are listening to us on your laptops or on your devices, you can go to that website, ejatlas.org. That's E-J-A-T-L-A-S, one word, .org. And you can actually pull up that map and look at where all the different pins are for the moment. Bear in mind that this project is not yet complete, okay? The EU funding is running for yet another year, and they're hoping that they'll be able to continue building through collaborations with academics and activists all over the world to a 2,000 case base, at least, by the close of the project and the beginning of new projects on this type of initiative in 2015. So we're pretty excited about that, and I wanted to just do a little more of a backstory about the folks in the studio with us today. I mentioned Sarah Orvis, who's here from a kind of trajectory in upstate New York. You grew up in upstate New York, correct?
Yeah, I grew up next to the St. Lawrence River. Up there, it's a very much a rural organization, rural area, but New York State has such large environmental justice conflicts. It's been really interesting to be able to expand and see the more urban areas of New York State, and as I've grown across the nation.
So that's great. We have this rural-urban interface in upstate New York that got you interested enough in EJ to come here to the University of Michigan to study it, which is fantastic. Another of your project teammates, though, had a completely different background, right? Alejandro Colza Perez, he grew up in Spain, if I'm not mistaken. And how the heck did you get into environmental justice work, may I ask?
Well, I am from Spain. I'm from Sevilla, the south part of Spain, and I am a geographer as an undergrad. In environmental justice in Spain, it's included within the field of geography. And I took a year abroad, and I went to Syracuse University, and I got to experience some of the work that people in Syracuse are doing with environmental justice. And I asked myself, this field that is really important in the U.S., what's happening in Europe? So I went back to Spain, and I got into contact with the few scholars that are doing some environmental justice work, and I started to get more excited about it, and I heard about University of Michigan, how it's one of the biggest schools doing environmental justice work, and I decided to apply for a Fulbright scholarship to come here and study, and I got it, and here I am, learning more about environmental justice movement in the U.S. and try to see how that is different from the European experiences that I have, and try to see, you know, where we go from here.
Fantastic. We're going to hear a lot more after our next tune about that background of EJ in the U.S. versus and EJ in Europe. What is environmental justice for an American? What is environmental justice for a European? And how are we building those bridges? But first, yet another homegrown environmental justice advocate, Bernadette Grafton on my right, who actually you had more of an awakening once you got to the University of Michigan, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, my interest in environmental justice didn't start until last year when I first jumped on board with this project. I was originally interested in brownfields and their redevelopment and engagement with communities in that process after an internship that I had with the U.S. EPA a few years ago. And so after that, I realized University of Michigan had a great program for just understanding human behavior and social engagement. And so that's how I got to where I am today.
Very different trajectories, my own, from growing up in Appalachia, the Smoky Mountains, and the other faculty member here at University of Michigan involved in this project, Paul Mohai, has long been involved with the environmental justice movement and the Michigan Coalition. That question, what about Michigan and what is environmental justice, is going to be top of our list when we come back from our next track. And all of you listening, if you have a definition for what environmental justice is, please call us and tell us what it is. We're at 763-3500. You can call in and tell us your definition of environmental justice. We're going to start talking about ours right after a track that is a classic in the U.S. EJ spirit of things. What do you got? Guthrie with This Land Is Your Land, a kind of fundamental treatise about public land belonging to everybody and not being despoiled by a few.
And this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walkin' that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling in the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling. Voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting.
You can tell us a little about it. Welcome back to the show. This is It's Hot in Here on WCBN FM, Radio Free Ann Arbor. I am here with Dr. Rebecca Hardin, Sarah, Bernadette, Alejandro, who are talking to us about their work for over the past year on environmental justice. Alejandro, environmental justice, you said you have some experience working with it in the past. What exactly does it, seems like a pretty packed term. What exactly does it mean? What does it mean to you coming from Spain? And then maybe you can talk to us a little bit about what it means to you now that you're here in Michigan.
That's like the million-dollar question that we get asked all the time, anywhere we go. What is justice? What does it mean? What is environmental justice? Well, I can tell you my opinion of it because, you know, after being exposed to academic and professional experience for the past 7 years. For me, a lot of times people talk about environmental justice as environmental burdens like air pollution, water pollution should be distributed evenly across space. Everyone should have the same because all our activity, the human activity, no matter what, we're going to have environmental burdens related to that. We're going to have some kind of air pollution, some kind of water pollution that shouldn't be concentrated in. And that shouldn't impact certain populations. That should impact all of us equally. But I also like to talk about that we also need to have an equal share of environmental goods. We should have an equal share of environmental benefits, like access to green spaces, access to healthy food. And that's something that sometimes people tend to forget about, but I like to emphasize that it's not only about we should have the environmental burdens equally distributed. Also, we all of us should have equal access to environmental goods. And lately, another thing that people usually don't consider is that we should all have a meaningful participation on the decision-making process. So it's not only about making sure that everything is equally distributed. Everyone needs to have a say in how things are distributed, in how they can have an input on decision-making.
All right. So I guess, you know, the importance of this topic is also brought about by the fact that currently we don't have perfect environmental justice, right?
Right.
Rebecca just pointed out the formal definition of environmental justice according to the US EPA, which is the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of people of all races, cultures, incomes, and educational levels with respect to the development and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. And just to read on a little bit more, fair treatment means that no group of people should bear a disproportionate share of the negative environmental consequences resulting from industrial, governmental, and commercial operations or policies. Would you guys agree with that? Do you think that's pretty comprehensive? Is something missing there?
Well, as I mentioned, I think what it's missing, it's when we talk, we go and talk to community members, they all agree with that. But they also want to have a sustainable community. They want to have a place where their children can play, where they want to have access to healthy food. They don't want to have to be forced to go to, not have access to healthy food in grocery stores. So those things, that the environmental goods is something that a lot of communities are focusing right now. And I think it's really important to consider when we talk about environmental justice.
Right. So it's not just CO2 emissions. We're talking about actual access to environmental goods.
Right.
And Alejandro, you explored that a little bit in an internship last summer, right? I remember when you first arrived in Ann Arbor, you said, I want to learn about how this U.S.-based thing happens, which is neighborhood level, community level. You don't see as much of that in Europe. Can you tell us what you were up to last summer?
Right. Yeah, you're right. When I'm coming from Europe, where environmental justice is more like a top-down approach. It's more about academics or governments trying to ensure that everyone has this equal share of goods or the environmental bets. But it's something completely different when I came here. Environmental justice is more a bottom-up approach where those communities that are impacted by these problems are ones that are saying, hey, we feel that we're not equally represented in the community. We're not fairly treated. And they're the ones saying we should do something against these injustices. So I went to work in this environmental justice organization called We Act for Environmental Justice, which they are based in West Harlem in New York City, in Manhattan. And it's a community that started because they realized that they had 7 out of the 8 bus depots in the city of New York. They were in their community. They had a marine transfer facility. So pretty much they were bearing all the environmental burdens of the whole city. They were all located within their community. They felt it was unfairly decided, and they have been fighting against that for more than 20 years. And I had an amazing experience there helping community organizers, public forums. It was just a great experience.
Perfect. And those public forums, was that within the community, or was that sort of gaining attention from the entire city? Did you see people from outside of the community really wake up to the fact that there's another community sort of bearing our burden?
Well, New York City is a really complicated space, and it's also huge. So the kind of efforts they were doing, it was pretty much about trying to bring the community members to the same table to realize about the problems that are in their communities, and to develop the strategies that they can draw in order to move the community to the next level towards a more sustainable and healthy community. And then our organization was also representing the community in more citywide debates. There was this group called the Green City Coalition, which is an umbrella organization representing different groups in the city pushing for sustainable development. So that was like the heart of the community, heard in a more citywide debate.
You know, it sounds like a lot of the issues that you ran into in that internship echo the ones you mentioned earlier in your definition, your expanded EJ definition of a place to live and play and grow and learn safely. And I wonder, maybe you could say a few words. You suggested, actually, this track that we want to cut to next for some music. It's from Mexico, right? This song?
Yeah, it's from this group called Maná. Spanish speaker know about this group because they're really, really famous. And it's a song called Donde Jugarán Los Niños, which means where are our children going to play? And it's a critique on we're changing our environment so much that things that we used to do when we were little, maybe our next generation are not going to be able to do it. So I think it's a pretty song.
Let's give it a listen. Fantastic suggestion. And I look forward to posting the link to the YouTube thing on our blog as well after the show today so people can find it if they like it. Maná. CBN FM 88.3 on your FM dial Ann Arbor. This is It's Hot in Here, your weekly environmental music and talk show. And this is Rebecca Harden in the studio with Andrea Krauss, your co-hosts, and a series of scholars and activists. We've got Sarah, Alejandro, and Bernadette here representing a team from University of Michigan that worked for a client, the EJOLT, EJOLT program. It's the Environmental Justice Organization's Liability and Trade Research Program, funded by the European Union. And we're talking today about how these students have built bridges between the insights of the environmental justice movement in the United States and emerging concerns about environmental justice in Europe and thinking across those divides. So I'm really curious, actually, about your research methods and how the work for the client, EJOLT, unfolded. Bernadette, can you tell us a little bit about how you guys coalesced as a team and came to your methods and gathered this information to put those pins on the map for U.S. conflict?
Yeah, so we were originally asked by EJOLT to essentially discuss the history of the environmental justice movement in the United States. And as we've been talking, that's a pretty pretty packed term, and there's a lot involved with that. There's also been a lot written about environmental justice in the United States. And so we realized that it would be great to get a better understanding of the social movement behind that and activism. And so that was our focus, was to really understand it through the lens of community activism, which was really intriguing for me, being interested in community engagement, which is why I jumped on board with this project. And so in doing that, we wanted to get input from the community itself and to really get an idea of where the movement has come from since its inception 30 years ago. And so we wanted to talk with activists. We wanted to talk with academics. And we were fortunate enough to have the guidance of our two advisors, Professor Paul Mohai and Rebecca Hardin, here with us in the studio, just able to get us in contact with these key leaders, key experts in the field. And we gained the trust of them, which was great, because we learned so much just through conversations with these people and through our interactions via email and the interviews that we had.
So you had a survey instrument too.
We had asked experts as well as the public to identify on a scale of level of influence that people believed each particular case has had in the movement. We had identified cases ahead of time and asked them to narrow it down for us. Reached out to experts, and we also had our survey featured on an EPA environmental justice blog, which was an excellent way to reach out to the wider community. We received 1,000 hits on that blog in just 2 weeks. So that was very encouraging for us, knowing that people were interested in what we were doing.
That is high. A lot of people have trouble with these online surveys in terms of response rates, so that's actually very, very unusual. Did you have skews in kind of the broader public response versus the academic expert response rates?
So what we found in doing our analysis is that the public responses tended to sway more towards what's been out in the media recently.
Mm-hmm.
So cases that, like Keystone Pipeline, for instance, or biodiversity cases, and just the bigger conflicts that are currently happening or have happened recently, those are the ones that were identified as being most influential. Whereas the experts that we had contacted directly via email, they were more aware of the historical cases
or
and the
ones
that
have
had a large impact on the movement
or
overall.
Or impacted laws and policy frameworks versus the media kind of impact.
Right.
So that's interesting. So how did you handle that in terms of your analysis and choosing the pins on the EJ Atlas map?
We didn't want the public to outweigh the knowledge that the experts have had and the research that they've done and the personal experiences that they've had in the movement. So we weighed the public and the expert sample 50-50, and we were able to come up with our list of top 40 through that.
But you didn't rank those top 40 in any way, right? You just kind of figured out which were the most influential.
Yeah, we didn't feel that it was really appropriate to rank any of the cases because environmental justice is a very broad issue. It's a sensitive issue for many people.
Uh-huh.
And that wasn't our goal, to rank on a scale of influence, rather to just identify.
Sure. In fact, if I recall, when you were yourself actually slaving away over the Qualtrics parameters last summer, you were creating a space on each of the categories you asked people about where they could write in other cases that you may have missed in your very extensive literature review.
Mm-hmm.
And that lit review, how was that structured? I mean, it was you did a lot of work before you even built the survey instrument, right? Like to figure out what had happened.
Yeah, we did many hours of internet research and just from our even course experiences that we've had, we used all of that knowledge and we tried to get as deep of an understanding of the environmental justice movement as we could and identify as many cases as we could based on the information available. But there's always missing cases. There's always something that we're not aware of, and we felt it was very important to provide that space for people.
Well, sure. And it's a dynamic thing, too, as to what constitutes a case, right?
Right.
Yeah, and I also wanted to point out that we didn't want just to have a large number of cases. We want cases to be representative, both geographically and thematically. Mm-hmm. So we divided the country in four regions, and each of the students got one region of the United States to make sure that, because if you type EJ in the U.S., you're going to end up always going to, like, those key cases that everyone talks about. But we wanted to have, like, a wider representation of cases by theme and by geographic location. I think we did a pretty good job. We had a pretty diverse, within our 90s, all the, 10 different categories, like ranking from waste management, water management, nuclear, industrial facilities.
Right, these conflicts were originally decided by our client, EJOLT, so we were following their framework.
Right.
Well, that's great. I mean, it sounds like a mountain of work, actually, just an absolute mountain. But like you say, each region has its own particular kind of personality around environmental conflicts. I mean, you, Bernadette, you come out of the Midwest. You're talking to me about, on the way over here, about how, for example, something like hydraulic fracturing is becoming more and more of an EJ issue.
Right. Every time my husband's family is in Ohio, and every time we go over there for the holidays, they are constantly telling me about fracking in their town. They live in Youngstown, Ohio, and that's a big issue for them, and in Pennsylvania.
Sure.
And even in Michigan. I mean, it's all over the Midwest.
Absolutely. Well, I was actually going to set us up for a little more music, and I think we actually have a song queued up that's about hydraulic fracturing or fracking. And this is kind of an interesting, it's an interesting song in the sense that it's produced in part through a collaboration between ProPublica and a New York media outlet that wanted to do a piece of work based on ProPublica's research into the way fracking is happening in rural American communities. So let's give that a listen, and then we'll come right back to the talking.
Sounds great.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drillers make a killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground, the pressure cranes finishes 7,000 feet down, the cracks release the gas that powers your town, that will frack, yeah, totally frack.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow, with names like benzene and formaldehyde. You better keep them far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below, the groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the residents of Sublet Wayo, that was frack. We're talking benzene.
What the frack is going on? With all this fracking going on, I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
So it all goes back to 2005. Bush said gas drillers didn't have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act before too long. It was fracked, baby, fracked until the break of dawn.
With the EPA out, it was up to the states, but they didn't have the money to investigate. Sick people couldn't prove fracking was to blame, all the while water wells were going up in flames.
Cause it's hard to contain all the methane released. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worse than CO2. Fracking done wrong, things to climate change too.
Now it's not that drillers should never be fracking, but the current regulation is severely lacking. Reduce the toxins contained in the gas and wastewater, and the people will get sick, and the planet will get hotter.
What the frack is going on? With all this fracking going on, I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire
tonight. Oh my gosh, it's hot in here on WCBN FM 88.3 Ann Arbor. And that was a song about hot hydraulic fracturing. And the water in my tap is on fire. These mics are on fire, too. We are talking about environmental justice today with the EJOLT team, the Environmental Justice Organization's Liabilities and Trade team. And I've got Sarah Orvis on the mic with me. I thought I would just ask her, what the heck is an EJO? What is an environmental justice organization? Is it like the same as an NGO? Is it different? And how are you studying that? I mean, what did you guys find out?
Well, that was one of our first big issues, is what is an EJL? We went online, we searched, and there was no definitive answer within the movement or within academia saying this is what an EJL looks like there is for an NGO. So we kind of came up with our own modern-day environmental justice organization definition. We were looking specifically at registered nonprofits as environmental justice organizations, who also were looking at the same issues that Alejandro talked about earlier of addressing environmental justice as not only environmental burdens, but environmental goods. And we're trying to make sure that there was a meaningful conversation going on with the communities, as well as other actors, including governmental actors, mainstream environmental groups, and NGOs.
So that must be challenging. I mean, I know that Bernadette was saying earlier, you guys had this awesome combination of kind of a larger scale survey instrument and then these in-depth qualitative interviews. And I wonder about, you know, in those conversations, those interviews, what kinds of things were you finding out about the tensions within these organizations in terms of growth, and what kinds of questions were you asking?
Well, we were finding out that there was a lot of different ideas going on about environmental justice organizations. As we had mentioned, there's very different groups working on this. So as they're moving forward, there are some groups that are really believing that they need to start working within the system. They need to work in the political process, working with these mainstream groups,
environmental groups.
And then there's groups that believe that this is not how it goes, and that's kind of making the basis of the movement that started out as community groups coming out of the civil rights movement as church-based groups or groups that were coming, that were already set up in these communities and very community-based. Now they're realizing that some groups need to move forward and they need to start becoming these nonprofits where they can be getting more funding, which will allow them to have more access to other organizations as well as more
impact, basically, voice
in their communities and in their state and nationally.
So there's almost, you could almost say it's an accountability or a legitimacy issue in a way, as far as like the growth and impact and funding models being in tension with the kind of place-based community accountability kind of basis.
Yeah, just coming as getting the respect that they deserve as a legitimate actor in this environmental justice field. A lot of times what are coming out is it's just government actors or these already established large NGOs. So now we're seeing that these smaller groups that have become
EJOs
are getting a legitimate spot at the table to talk about the issue because they're the ones dealing with it.
And so it sounds like a lot of what your project is doing is trying to help organizations like that or on that end of the spectrum understand more about where other organizations are in the world that are like them and be able to network transversely across national boundaries and regions. So if, you know, Ohio, EJ's all about fracking right now, or Michigan, but, you know, in the West, there are still mining town issues that might really connect well to the mining issues in parts of Africa or, you know, like that. It just is opening up the networking opportunities. Would you say that?
Exactly. And that's a big part of the modern day, I guess, environmental justice movement, that they're realizing they need these partnerships and networks to continue. These strategies that are working maybe for people in America, in the West, could be really great issues and great ideas that could be definitely modified to be used in other countries.
That's so, so fantastic. I mean, I know, Sarah, you're both a student and a professional now. You're actually working in the New York area, right? And you grew up there. What are you working on these days? What is your job?
Currently, I am doing a lot of stuff around field sampling, which is a good thing, just making sure that these environmental justice opportunities aren't allowed to happen, that people have to be meeting these requirements and these standards. I think New York in particular is a really great kind of case study for environmental justice because they range from everything that's very, very rural. Things like the Akwesasne Mohawk Reservation in northern New York,
right. That's
very rural, to problems like WEACT is facing in New York City. They're very different, but they are all happening in the same state. So these regulations are a lot different and need to be addressed, but it's difficult with that kind of difference.
So your field sampling is partly about assessing those kinds of issues and networking across those rural and urban divides within New York State. You actually came over here, got your degree, and took it right back home to where the problems were. I really admire that. I think that's so fantastic. And I know that Alejandro also is headed back to Europe. We'll hear from him later about, you know, each of this team members are taking these issues forward. But while we're talking about upstate New York and contiguous areas where you've had these issues with pollution of waterways and so on, I thought we might just check out a really fabulous tune, which is yet another E.J. anthem. It's The Pretenders, Chrissy Hynde with My City Was Gone, and it's one of my favorite E.J. rock and roll songs. I'd love to take a listen. Oh, Chrissy Hynde and The Pretenders, such a joy to listen to that song, and such anger in it about, well, environmental justice issues. It's hot in here. WCBN-FM, 88.3 Ann Arbor, and we are sitting in the studio with an EJ team, Alejandro Bernadette and Sarah, talking to us about their work with Katie Hinson, Professor Paul Mohai, myself, Rebecca Hardin, and extensive guidance from a couple of scholars on the European continent that I think we should give a quick shout out to. We haven't said all that much about them, but you guys just got back, like last week, right, from these amazing meetings in Sweden. Can you tell me more? There were like two kind of, it was like a double header conference in Lund, Sweden, right? What were the meetings? What were you guys doing over there?
Well, so our client, the EJOLT, has an annual, so it's a 5-year project. So they meet at least once. They try to do twice a year. They meet in different places around the world, and they can bring together the people that are working in the project. And it's like a way of like putting all the research that everyone is doing together and have a conversation about where the project is going, how we're distributing our materials to the wider public, and how to make it better so that everyone has. We can like start this collaborative approach. So the main goal of our trip was to go to the EJOLT conference in Lund, Sweden, that was hosted by Professor Alf Holmberg from University of Lund, which is an environmental historian, and he's been doing a lot of work with in the same field as the other coordinator of the project, Joan Martinez Allier. So the conference itself was focused on some of the work that they've been doing on ecological and equal exchange, which, in my opinion, it's a way of calling environmental justice in a more international now north-south context, or the way they like to call it, center-periphery.
Okay, and ecologically unequal exchange. That's a cool phrase.
That it's, yeah, I don't know if that's as easy to understand as it sounds.
Ecologically unequal exchange. Well, it reminds me of fair trade, for example, or something like that, except it's a little more specific, right? And I hear what you're saying, too, is it kind of conjures up the core and periphery stuff from an earlier generation of world systems theorists, all those gigantic sociologists, you know, Manuel Wallerstein, you know, the whole idea that the world's not fair.
Right.
And justice frameworks can be different from culture to culture, actually. So that's a very interesting set of issues.
And just as a non-EJ expert, that sounds a lot to me like the conversation around climate change and global north, global south, adaptation, the means to adaptation. Is all that part of that exchange?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. During the conference, I had absolutely no idea what this was until the end of it. So I was completely new. I learned a lot. but it was really eye-opening to see where people are at, especially in countries like Nigeria, and how they're affected by this north-south relationship and this unequal exchange, and in countries in South America and really the material exchange of goods. And
what's also great is to see how these minds, like Alf Hornberg, has done a lot of work on technology and how technology structures inequality in capitalist systems. Or Juan Martinez Allier has worked for a long, long time. His foundational work on the environmentalism of the poor is something like when I was in grad school, I was like, wow, who is this guy? I want to meet him. You know, so you see these kind of career trajectories on these issues, studying and watching and caring and staying engaged, and then merging and building broader platforms, which I think is extremely powerful and very hopeful, right? It makes me feel very, very hopeful indeed about the capacity of humans to kind of figure some of these things out and start getting them righter than we have in most of our history, right? Because people do make mistakes. And so was the conference pretty uplifting? And let me ask, too, did people respond well to your methods and your study? What was the response that you guys got when you presented this stuff over there?
Well, as Bernadette said, it was eye-opening for a lot of us to see how I think it was eye-opening for us, but also for when we were presenting our results. So we got the experience to see how, you know, out of Western environmental justice field of study, how everything is different when you take into account that center, periphery, or north-south consideration. But I think it was also interesting for us to give a presentation. And the way I presented it is like, okay, we had a whole day talking about the north-south center, periphery. Now we're going to talk about how we think the center, which could be like a country like the U.S., there is periphery within the center. You can have even within a city like New York City, which it's like a world capital of capitalism, you have some periphery within a core capitalist city. So that was like also interesting point of view. And in terms of like how they like our methodology, they were really interested in how we got into those 40 cases and how it was like a way of following a methodology that could be representative and it could be respectful of a movement that is really sensitive of ranking and choosing what cases are included and what not. We wanted to make sure that no one was hurt when we were choosing why that case and what not the other. And some of the regions that in the world that are still to be included in the EJL map, they are interested in using the methodology that we used that they, for some reason, they call the Michigan method.
Oh my goodness, the Michigan method. I love like the Michigan Coalition in the 1990s that
exactly.
was a kind of conference and meeting of minds here and later went on to become like one of the first and most formative interfaces of academic and activist communities, right?
Right.
That's great. Congratulations on that.
That's great. And I think Italy right now, it's the one that they're in touch with us, some of the activists in Italy, and they want to know how we did it and how that could be used in Italy, because it's different depending on where you are, because we have to acknowledge that the infrastructure that we have in the U.S. and the existing of a movement makes it easier for us to develop the methodology that we did. Can you do a methodology like the one we used in a country like Mozambique? Probably not. It has to be a different kind of methodology.
So or maybe be adapted.
Right.
But the basic principles of combining quantitative and qualitative research mm-hmm. and consulting a wide variety of stakeholder communities, I mean, those would hold true, I think, in a lot of different settings. And although I know it's been a lot of work, and it actually kind of reminds me of this next track that we had up. It's a song by Joni Mitchell in which she talks about how you don't know what you've got till it's gone. And that seems to me like it's both about environment and sometimes about data, right? Like you're working on something. You want to publish it, and sometimes when you get those data in, you realize, or you try to write that article, you realize you don't have what you need to make a rigorous argument. So this combination of research and rigor with kind of community accountability and respect for movements that are not, you know, based in universities, very delicate dance. And I want to try to encourage us to do that to the strains of Joni Mitchell for a few minutes. Take it away, Joni.
Paradise put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. Charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We paid paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We paid paradise, put up a parking lot. We paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Oh, sorry, WCBN-FM 88.3 Ann Arbor. We're here talking about environmental justice and singing some fantastic songs, hearing some fantastic songs. I mean, hearing them. I wanted to come back to this question of culmination. Like, you guys, so basically you did all this work for the European Union-funded E-JOLT project. So you studied, as you know, Alejandro told us, these core definitions of environmental justice and how they differ between different countries. You developed these survey methods that Bernadette told us about that really opened up the assessment of impact of environmental justice cases to a wide range of respondents here in the U.S. And then you dug in deeper, as Sarah told us, with a selection of leaders and activists. And Sarah, you said that interview base you had was really balanced, right? You had a wide range of people, both women and men. What did that look like exactly?
Well, we realized that the environmental justice movement in the United States was so unique that we really needed to have people that would represent all of these different ideas. We wanted to have activists that have been working on the ground since the beginning, academics who usually started out as activists. We also wanted to make sure we specialized and got experts on things like indigenous rights, that is a unique part of it,
right.
And different aspects of the environmental justice movement. So we ended up about 30 interviews, 27 different organizations represented in a very wide geographic region. So we're really happy with our results of that.
That is fantastic. Now, you just, if I'm not mistaken, Sarah, you just presented those results, indeed the whole initiative, yesterday at the SNRE, right? Can you tell us for whom you presented yesterday and what's going on over there today?
Yeah, so this is really exciting. We all have our capstone projects to present. We're not the only project going on at SNRE right now. There's a bunch of different projects going on, projects that are across the globe. And I promise you, these people have put their heart, sweat, and tears, everything into these projects for the last year and a half, 2 years. They're amazing projects going on. People have been doing amazing things with really awesome clients. It's definitely worth the time to go over there. It's at the SNRE building, Dana building on the Diag. Definitely check it out. It's till 5 o'clock this afternoon.
Fantastic. I know for your panel yesterday, we had everything from environmental justice movements to bee colonies in Greece and the impact of dams on the fisheries of the Huron watershed. I mean, it was an awesome range of clients and challenges, always with this mix of like where people live and work with how you bend science to make those things better. So I was really impressed. We had one on buses on the island of Hawaii yesterday. It was very cool. So I definitely recommend people checking that out. I guess, though, it's not just graduate students that are really getting switched on to this stuff on the U of M campus right now. I know that our program in the environment, the awesome Growing Like a Mushroom undergraduate major and minor, well, actually, they're rolling out a minor in environmental justice for the program in the environment right now, and thinking about what that curriculum will look like for undergrads, because there are so many undergraduates founding organizations and banding together around issues, everything from the Keystone Pipeline to the conflict minerals in the Congo. I mean, we have, and we'll post some links on the WCBN Hot in Here website to some of the student EJ initiatives that you all should know about. I know there's like a hike for the Congo that's being sponsored the weekend of May 2nd, 3rd, 4th. I think it's on May 3rd. And that's all student-driven engagement in some of the field projects that are appearing as pins on the EJ Atlas map. Mm-hmm. So very nice to connect those dots in the way that you only can, in a way that combines student energy with, you know, more mature research minds. I think it's great. But about that map, Bernadette, you were saying they're not done with it yet, right? What's the situation there?
No, I mean, as we were saying, this project runs through 2015, and EJOLT really wants to get at least 2,000 cases or conflicts mapped by then. And so this takes a lot of energy and a lot of time. And so they're trying to enlist the help of people around the world, and we're just one group in the United States doing this, and we're really hoping that all of you listening and more would log on to the ejatlas.org website and check it out. And if you're aware of any other cases, to add those, spread the word.
I mean, it's like citizen science in some way.
This is the only way it's going to be effective, is if we add more cases.
Can I ask a question really quick?
Yes.
So it's through 2015. Is your hope that there's more continuation to the map thereafter, or is there something in particular you really hope that the map is going to be utilized for in particular at that point?
Well, original goal of this map was to really create a resource and a platform for activists around the world to connect with people in other countries dealing with similar conflicts, and to learn from each other, and to create those strong networks and share resources. So that's the hope, and the only way to do that is to get as many conflicts mapped as possible. And I believe this is going to be an ongoing project. Just the funding ends in 2015.
We're already, I think, having conversations among participants in this chapter of the EJOLT project about where it might go from here. I know that the leadership of EJOLT, based in Europe, is exploring whether we might field more transnational teams for looking at China, Southeast Asia. These are some of their priority areas in coming years that we hope to be able to help them with. And of course, as Bernadette mentioned, the work of continuing to document what's happening in the U.S. goes on. I would add that as the map matures, the issue of not only how many can we map, but how carefully can we map them? And this intervention of like the Michigan method or related research design interventions that sort of combine citizen science with some careful sampling strategies and survey strategies. And that allows this map to be a base layer, like you often find in research, that people could come back to over time. People could go back into the sites on the map and monitor what's changed, what outcomes have been. So I like to think it could begin to create, although there's always a problem with this broad and ambitious a project, but it could begin to create better science on these issues.
Right. The map is only as useful as the information that's on it. So
that's
hopefully
exactly right.
This method will continue.
Well, I want to just thank all of you and your mentors, Alf Hornberg, Juan Martinez Allier, your collaborators, Leah, and the team in Barcelona. My collaborator, Paul Mohai, is a faculty advisor on this project. Andrea and Jennifer for being like, yeah, that'd be a cool show. And Gus for virtuosic work in the studio, engineering all these different tunes and discussions. We have had a great show today, and I want to take it out with the, I think I want to to take it out with the Talking Heads. I went to school in Providence, Rhode Island. Whenever I can fit the Talking Heads into a show, I do. Thank you for tuning in to It's Hot in Here for our environmental justice organizations, liabilities, and trade talk today. And check us out online.